This is West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. 70 years ago this month, the world began to learn much greater detail about the atrocities committed in Nazi Germany as Allied forces liberated several concentration camps. Doris Bergen has extensively studied and written about the Holocaust. The University of Toronto professor is the author of several books, including War and Genocide, A Concise History of the Holocaust. Bergen will speak tonight at Kalamazoo College. Her address is called Holocaust or Genocide, Uniqueness and Universality. Doris Bergen, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
I want to begin by asking you about the title of this address, because it says Holocaust or Genocide, there's a question mark. Is there a meaningful difference between the idea of Holocaust and genocide?
Well, I think the term genocide is really a broader term, right? That's used to describe many cases of extreme violence. We talk about the Armenian genocide, marking, of course, 100 years since it began in 1915, since it occurred. So genocide is a broader term. Holocaust refers specifically to Nazi German programs of mass killing during World War II. But there, what I wanted to raise with that title and that question mark is the issue of comparison. You know, many people wonder, is it helpful to compare the Holocaust with other genocides? What do we learn from comparing? So that's what I'm really trying to get at there. How do we think about different cases of extreme violence in relation to each other?
And in some cases, do people not want to make a comparison because they want to set the Holocaust off by itself? It's such a horrible thing that you can't compare it to something else. Is that the idea what you're getting at there, that we don't want to compare those two things, or we may be reluctant to?
Sometimes people are reluctant to compare them. Sometimes comparisons can be misused as a kind of one-upmanship, right, to sort of have a competition or a hierarchy of suffering. What I'm trying to show and what I'm going to emphasize in my talk is that, in fact, comparisons are extremely valuable. They can also be, well, they are necessary. They can be a very powerful way to help people relate and connect with events that can seem very long ago and far away.
You begin the book War and Genocide by saying that in order for a house to burn down, there have to be preconditions. And you say that's also true for the Holocaust. So give us an idea. What were those preconditions that were already in place that then eventually helped create the Holocaust?
Well, the reason I use that analogy of a house on fire is I'm trying to show conditions that were in place and some that were new, because what I say there is for a building to burn down, you really need three things. You need that dry timber. That's what I think of as maybe pre-existing ideologies, anti-Semitism, hatred, prejudices, social tensions. Those are things that make timber dry and combustible. But it's not going to start burning unless someone lights a match, the spark. And that I refer to as the role of the leadership. In the case of the Holocaust, Hitler, the Nazi power in Germany, but other genocides too. They never are simply a spontaneous eruption. There's somebody who, let's say, lights the match. And then the third condition that I bring up there is what I call the favorable weather. You know, if some building is burning and it starts raining, it's not going to keep burning. But if you have a kind of dry conditions, maybe a bit of a light wind that fans the flames, that's going to take that combustible timber, that spark, and turn it into a conflagration. And there, what I was thinking of is the surrounding conditions of war. War is often a terrible facilitator for extreme violence. It can provide the kind of, conducive circumstances. So that's what I was thinking of. Preconditions, those are often, like I say, ideological, social, you know, tensions, pre-existing tensions within a society. But you still need that leadership to galvanize those, to mobilize them. And you need the conditions that allow them to turn from kind of simmering, you know, discontent or, you know, ongoing, maybe low-level violence to full-blown genocide.
You also say in your book that the Holocaust was not uniquely German. What do you mean by that?
Well, what I mean, first of all, is if you think about, you know, one of the really crucial preconditions in isolating Jews as a major target was, of course, anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism, hatred of Jews, it was by no means, you know, a particularly German or uniquely German phenomenon. There's important elements of anti-Jewish thought built into Christianity, for instance. There's also 19th century, you know, racial notions that easily, you know, spread from place to place, eugenic ideas. You got to remember the first targets of mass killing in Nazi Germany were not Jews, but people with disabilities. And so those, you know, notions of, well, you know, who was to be considered a useless eater and so on, these things were very widespread. You had eugenics movements in North America, in other parts of Europe. You had extreme violence in European colonial systems, racism, social Darwinism. None of these things stopped at the borders of Germany. So there I was talking about a whole sort of complex of ideas that could be mobilized and that indeed had pretty wide traction.
The final chapter of your book is called Legacies of Atrocity. What are those legacies of atrocity in the Holocaust as we look back now 70 years into the past when World War II came to an end?
Boy, that is a really hard question to answer briefly. So let me see what I can say to that. Well, the first thing I guess I'm going to say is it's not as easy as we like to think. You know, often people say, what are the lessons? There's not necessarily such obvious lessons, but I guess a couple things that I'd point to as legacies is, first of all, to say, you know, one of the key things easily forgotten, big, huge outcome of the Holocaust is a terrible, terrible loss. You know, we tend to talk now, and of course it makes sense, about survivors, about triumph and resilience, but you have to think about what Europe was like in the spring of 1945. You know, people who had no idea whether anyone but them from their family had survived, even whether their entire community was left, people who didn't know, could they go home, what was home, people who, not just Jews, but others too, you know, there were millions of forced workers, Poles, Ukrainians, you know, French and other forced workers who at the end of the war found themselves in Germany, newly occupied Germany, massive numbers of displaced persons, you know, people who, yeah, had nowhere to go, no one to turn to, people who'd lost their children. Easily forget about this, right? We think about orphans, very heart-wrenching situation of orphans. But think about the other side of that, you know, a mother or a father whose children were killed or who had no idea where those children were. So that incredible sort of loss. And to look back and think, how did people try to rebuild functioning societies? You know, it's easy to look at all the different sort of failures, but it's also quite astonishing to think in 70 years, the kinds of families, communities, societies, you know, regimes, governments, that people somehow managed to put together. So that, both a legacy of loss and then intertwined with it, a kind of, yeah, I don't know, resourcefulness or resilience. It's quite astonishing. And of course, there are many other, you know, concrete things. We think about issues of justice. You know, most people have heard about the Nuremberg trials. You think about, you know, the importance of trying to bring some kind of justice to, you know, a world so torn apart. And there's also smaller ways where, for instance, you know, the Soviets, it's easily forgotten, often had commissions like created just on the ground, trying to deal with, you know, collaboration, with crimes committed in the areas that they liberated. And, you know, we easily forget this, thinking about Allied liberation. You mentioned this in, you know, the spring of 1945. You know, the Red Army, the Soviet Army, they were allies too, right? They liberated major camps and killing centers. Auschwitz was liberated in January 1945 by the Soviets, Majdanek, months earlier. So they came across that evidence of, you know, mass killing much before the Western Allies did. So you have, you know, the attempt to kind of come to terms with what does it mean to do justice? You know, not only to punish, but to kind of make possible creations of viable societies. You can't punish everybody. So I think that's another legacy, very, very important. And there were efforts before World War II as well, you know, to have some sorts of international justice, post-war justice, but you see it on a huge scale there.
So World War II is an event which has been the subject of countless books, many movies. There are many people who have written about it, spoken about it, studied it. When you write about it, or when you come and speak about it at a place like Kalamazoo College, is there a certain area where you think you really dwell on? Is there a certain misconception or a myth that you want to clear up? Or is there a certain period of history there that you want to fill in the details on when you talk about World War II?
This is a great question. I hope I can do justice to it with an answer. You know, the thing is that I have a number of things that I really, really care about. One of them is I really want to emphasize the way in which World War II and the Holocaust were global events, not limited to Germany, not limited to Europe, you know, that they really had repercussions all over the world. And I mean, there's so many examples, but I'll just give you, you know, one kind of obvious one. You know that something like 18,000 Central European Jews, mostly from Germany, from Austria, survived the war in Shanghai. Survived the war in Shanghai. We don't usually think of Shanghai as a place linked to the Holocaust. It's enormously important. It's just one example. So I really try to emphasize the global dimensions of the Holocaust and of the war itself. I think that's crucial. The other thing that I think is really important to emphasize is, I guess, what I would call the kind of step-by-step nature of events. You know, often people ask, how did it happen? You know, how could such terrible things happen? A great scholar of the Holocaust, Raoul Hilberg, used to answer that question, and I like to borrow his answer, step by step. You know, you have 6 years of peacetime in Nazi Germany before the war, preparation, you know, of attacks on Germany's neighbors, of attacks against certain elements of the population, and this idea of chronology, that things happened step by step, I think it's really important both to understand those events and to understand our own world. In other words, it's not that things are inevitable. You can't always tell where those steps are leading. You know, I'm not saying it makes the future predictable at all. If anything, the opposite. But you see the kind of linkages, if you know what I mean, between actions, decisions, unforeseen consequences, often in quite different places. The complexity, I guess, is what I would call it, the complexity of human history. Difficult, complicated events have complicated causes.
Doris Bergen, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Doris Bergen is a professor at the University of Toronto and the author of War and Genocide, A Concise History of the Holocaust. She will speak tonight at Kalamazoo College. More details on Doris Bergen's address this evening and a longer version of this interview can be found at WMUK.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.